To the end of the book, and we have some exciting things to talk about. What I consider one of the just most awesome stories in the Bible. I thought that even when I was a kid. I didn't, when I was younger, enjoy reading the Bible, but I actually got to where I like so much the story of Joseph that I just keep reading it, even if I'd completed my quota of whatever I thought I needed to read for that day. So we were looking at the fact that Joseph at 17 had brothers who hated him because he tattled on them, because of the dreams, because of the father's favoritism and that coat. And so Jacob sends Joseph out to check on his brothers who are way far away, dozens of miles away, herding the flocks and cattle and so forth. And they see him from afar off. And he's in uniform. He's got that coat on. That's about like waving a red flag in front of bulls. They see that, they're seething, and they're like, we can put a stop to those dreams right here and now. You know, and so they decide, you know, we'll just kill him. But Reuben's, well, you know, he's our brother, you know, maybe we shouldn't kill him. He actually, as the oldest son, probably felt more responsible. He was going to come behind him and rescue him. So they threw him into a pit. And it's really interesting that their plan to sabotage his dreams is what actually ends up fulfilling his dreams. It leads to that. And so they strip him of his robe and they throw him in the pit with no water, and then they sit down to eat. It's interesting that their mistreatment of their brother doesn't diminish their appetite. I don't know this, but I'm assuming Joseph probably had a care package for them or something, and they were eager to get to the food that has been given to them. But it shows a lot of callousness on their part. They surely don't think about Joseph. And Reuben's wherever, and they see some traitors going down to Egypt. It's like, hey, we got a better idea than killing him. Let's make a buck. So they sell him as a slave. Reuben gets back, and he's like, oh no, what'd you do with him? He again, you can kind of see the responsibility he feels as the oldest son. So they take Joseph's coat. They dip it in goat's blood. They come to their father and they say, we found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not. Now, do you recall Jacob's deceit? Using his brother's clothing and goat skin. Now he's deceived by his sons using their brother's clothing and goat's blood. You kind of reap what you sow. They are really strategic in how they do this because the power of suggestion is stronger than the power of explanation. Just kind of bring the coat and like, we found this. Is it your son's? They let Jacob draw his own conclusions. He sees it and it's like, it's my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. And he is so grieved. And he is constantly grieved. This was his favorite son. This was the memory of his dear wife. And his sons and daughters arose to comfort him. And he refused to be comforted. He says, I'll go down to the grave mourning my son. You don't know what the brothers are thinking or feeling at this point, but do you suppose that the constant grief and mourning of their son, of their father rather, could have finally led them to feel some guilt? And it's a guilt they can't deal with because they can't tell their father what they did. He's really not dead. At least a wild animal didn't devour him like their father thought. But they can't say that. So this is, we're not really sure what's going on in their minds or hearts here. But we know Jacob is constantly mourning the loss of his son. The Midianites, meanwhile, have sold Joseph to the captain of the bodyguard of Pharaoh, the Potiphar. And we leave him for a chapter, kind of increasing the suspense at wondering what's happening to him while we focus on a story that involves Judah. Now, I'm not going to go into this story for now in chapter 38, but Judah ends up playing the total hypocrite and is immoral with his ex-daughter-in-law who dresses up as a lady of the night. But I will suggest a couple of reasons why I think he's kind of throws this story right in the middle of the Joseph story. You know, if you're reading this, it's like 37's Joseph, 39 and following are Joseph, but right in there is 38 talking about Judah has nothing to do with Joseph. So why did he do it that way? Couldn't he have told that story first or last or whatever? Well, I think he told it this way for a purpose, maybe two. Think about these. The most obvious purpose is it's a contrast of Judah's immorality in 38 with Joseph's high standards of morality in 39. He jumps at the chance to be immoral. Joseph persistently refuses. So I think you see almost by this contrast an emphasis on Joseph's impressive purity. But I wonder if the whole chapter, if you look at it from beginning to end, is not showing the increasing Canaanite influence in Jacob's family and the importance of getting the family out of Canaan before they just turn totally Canaanite. And perhaps this is setting us up for what's going to happen eventually with the Joseph story, where the whole family moves down to Egypt in kind of a segregated part of Egypt in Goshen, where they can kind of be to themselves and perhaps have less influence from the pagans around them. I imagine that may be a part of this too. I don't know. I'll pause. And do you have some questions or comments you want to offer on 37 or 38? Okay, look at 39. This is such a good story. Just really remarkable. Joseph's a slave, late teenager, servant to the captain of the bodyguard. But God's with him. God's with him. God's with him. You see that over and over again. And he's successful. And he's, you know, he's grows in his influence. The Potiphar trusts him. He puts him in charge of the household servants. He's got an honorable position. Joseph suffers, however, from one endowment too many. In the end of verse 6, he's handsome in form and appearance. And that creates him a problem. Because Mrs. Potiphar falls in love with him, lust with him, whatever. And she says, lie with me. He refuses. But I want you to think about the challenge to Joseph of the temptation of Ms. Potiphar. He could have easily felt sorry for himself. And if you feel sorry for yourself, you are setting yourself up to fall into sin. Because it's so easy to mentally justify our sin when we feel sorry for ourselves. So I'm encouraged by the fact that he doesn't let himself feel that way, though he so easily could. He could have let the success in Potiphar's house go to his head. You know, sometimes we do badly because things are going well for us, and he doesn't do that. She is persistent. She just keeps after him. She forever reopens the closed question. And a lot of times Satan will wear us down by the constant attrition of temptation that we just can't get away from. And so it's impressive that he continues to be firm. Temptation is not a part-time experience for the believer. We're going to be tempted and tempted and tempted and tempted. And it's sometimes like, I might as well just give in and get it over with. No, it never makes you better to give in. Every temptation you resist, every 10 minutes you keep resisting it, makes you stronger. It's better. It's always wrong to do wrong. And it's always right to do right. And it's, I would think it'd be somewhat flattering for Ms. Potiphar to show an interest in Joseph. That could have been a temptation to him. And finally, she just grabs him. Now, it's interesting, Joseph's approach. He says in verse 8, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he's put all things that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he's withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? He is very strong. This would be an abuse of the trust of Potiphar. It would be a great sin against God. In verse 10, he refuses even to lay down beside her. He is not going to do anything that puts him in a compromising position. He cares about God even after what his brothers did to him, and he stays firm. When she finally finds the time he's alone in her house, he has to work there. I don't think this was just like a choice to hang out with her. But he's working there, and she's got a moment, and she grabs him by his coat. Now, you know what we do sometimes? I just couldn't help it. You know, it was just one of those things, I resist, and then there's nothing I could do. Yes, there is. There's always a way to escape temptation. Isn't that what 1 Corinthians 10:13 says? Don't ever convince yourself, I just couldn't help it. With the temptation, he is faithful to provide the way of escape. The way of escape in this case, leave your coat in her hand. Better to lose a good coat than good character. And flee. And that's what he does. He doesn't stay to look at temptation. He doesn't stay to negotiate. He gets away. Fleeing fornication, 1 Corinthians 6:18, is the only way to deal with that. And so, she grabs him. He leaves the coat in her hand, and he's out the door. She sees what he did. I suspect she feels scorned. She feels rejected. She feels angry. I don't know that she understood his integrity. She may have just thought she wasn't pretty enough for him. I don't know. But she's angry. And she's got his coat. And she screams. And she says to the men of her household in 14, see, he has brought in a Hebrew to make sport of us. He came in to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. Do you see what she did there? That's almost right. Did she scream? Was his garment left behind? Yeah, it sounds like she told the truth. She reversed the order of events, though. She didn't scream and then he fled. He fled and then she screamed. That makes a difference. He didn't exactly leave his coat beside her. It was left in her hand where she'd grabbed it. A few little details changed the whole complexion of that story. Evidently, her husband believes her. At least he acts on what she says and imprisons Joseph. Now, think about if you were an Egyptian. You probably, you know, if you're reading the National Enquirer or whatever, would get some kind of, information about this salacious tale of this Hebrew. Do you think that where there's smoke, there's always fire? If there's a rumor, it might not be exactly true, but there's probably something behind it. Sometimes there is. Sometimes there's not. Was there any truth whatsoever behind what Potiphar's wife was alleging, insinuating? Did Joseph in some way act irresponsibly in this situation? I don't think he did one thing wrong. There are times when there are absolutely unfounded rumors. We need to be very careful that we do not judge things by hearsay. It's easy to do. He who answers a matter before he hears it's a folly and shame to him. Proverbs 18, either 13 or 17, I can't remember which. So, he goes to jail, all because he did the right thing. What has he done wrong in this story? He's been sold by his brothers to slavery when he's 17, and now he's thrown in prison. For what? For doing the right thing. Do what's right, and this is what it'll get you. Don't forget that. Because there are times when it's like, what am I doing wrong? Or this shouldn't happen this way. I mean, I did the right thing, and we almost get mad at God. He should never let somebody go through something like what I'm going through. I'm doing what's right. What about Joseph? Ever been sold by your brothers into slavery? Ever been lied to and thrown in prison? I mean, we got it made. It's not true that if you do what's right, you won't have any difficulties or any painful experiences. Thoughts and comments. It's a good story, isn't it? So things are going good in prison for him. God's with him again, and he's trusted and put in charge of the prisoners. And you remember how the butler and the baker both have a dream. Joseph interprets both of their dreams. And the butler, cupbearer, he's going to be restored after 3 days. Baker's going to be hung after 3 days. Both of those happen just like he said it would. God gave him the answer to those dreams. And he asked the cupbearer, remember me before Pharaoh. Can't you imagine Joseph's level of expectation when the cupbearer leaves the prison? Is he going to mention me today? Tomorrow? Next day? Next week? Next month? You hate those things where your hope just sort of, you know, gradually diminishes. You know, because there's no definite time limit, but it gets clearer and clearer. Something's going wrong here. Did he forget me? Did the Pharaoh not believe him? You know what? It's so hard to get your hopes up and then have them dashed. There is so much injustice in Joseph's life. The brothers abuse him. Miss Potiphar lies about him. The cupbearer forgets him. You know, he's twice advanced and then set aside. It's hard to be patient. It's hard to keep trusting in God. Now, here's the thing. That Joseph story, this is not so hard for us. We know how it's going to end. I know Joseph's going to come out on top and it was all a good thing in the long run. How did he know that? He goes from 17, for best I can read the chronology, from sold at 17 to put in as vice Pharaoh at 30. 13 years of slavery and imprisonment, and he doesn't know it's only going to be 13 years. And he doesn't know that something good's going to happen at the end. Would you stay faithful to God for 13 years like this, not having any idea that it was going to end after 13 years? That's a lot of faith. That's an amazing character he has here. And what about that cupbearer? Isn't it so easy to forget blessings you've received and be ungrateful? You rejoice in the blessing, completely forget about those who helped you along the way. Well, it turns out that the cupbearer's forgetfulness works in Joseph's favor, since at the opportune moment he remembers Joseph, when Pharaoh has his dreams, and that leads to Joseph being brought in and interpreting the dreams, the 7 years of plenty and then the 7 years of famine, and I advise you to get somebody to stock up the food. And Pharaoh said, who better than Joseph? Who told me the meaning of the dream? And so Joseph goes from prisoner to vice Pharaoh in charge of famine relief in a day. You never know what's going to happen in a day. And suddenly he's on top of everything. And really, you know, only the Lord could have done something this dramatic. Joseph has been faithful over little things. Now he will be ruler over all the land of Egypt. And what if Joseph had given in to Miss Potiphar? You don't know what the consequences of your actions will be. It's always right to do right. It's always wrong to do wrong. You don't know what's happening to you right now will lead to. God's in control. He causes all things to work together for the good of those who love him. We need to take care of loving him. He'll take care of working him out for our good in the long run. Thoughts and comments through chapter 41. Yeah, Jimmy. And patience.
All together. There's absolutely no telling how many times we've got a prayer and ask for this to change, ask for this situation to get better, or whatever, and maintain this faith and blessing God.
Yeah, amen. Good point. Yes. You know, you wonder about that with him. This is amazing. He clearly must have had great faith and trust in God. Think about this. If Joseph had known the end of the story, it would have been easy not to be bitter, right? If he'd have known that this was going to turn out for good and it was going to be a blessing in the end, I think it's fairly easy to understand how he forgave his brothers after he knew everything that was going to happen and after it had all turned out well. So what if we knew this? What if we knew that while we don't know the specifics, God really will cause everything to work together for our good if we love Him? Then anything that happens to me, God will cause it to work together for my good. I don't know how. So I'm not Joseph if he could have seen the future. But I know that it's true. I know God's done it over and over again. I know He'll do it for me. So every situation, I know God's in control. I can trust Him. He'll work it for my good. What's there to be resentful and bitter about if it's really going to turn out for a good conclusion in the end? Yes.
13 years.
I know. So it tests our trust. But do we really believe God will do that? Do we believe we can trust God? Has God proven Himself throughout all kinds of stories and even in our life that He really will come through? It's really a lesson in trust. I mean, if we trust God, then I think we can avoid bitterness. If we can't, we won't. And there are challenges in that. Wow, Gil. And that whole passage in Lamentations 3 is really helpful along that line, Mike.
I think along this line, as Christians, we may have struggles and sometimes enormous struggles. Our challenge is to focus our mind on the home that God has prepared for us in heaven so vividly that no matter if you have to live a life of cancer for 50 years and then die, eternal glory, it's not easy to process. The other thing we say, well, 13 years, that's a long time. What is James used to illustrate our life by paper? So 13 years, yes, from one perspective it's long, but there's another perspective it's not long at all.
So we need to keep our perspective focused on the Lord. Norm? And perfectly appropriate that he do that. Yes, I agree. Lots of things to think about. Yes.
I just thought of something. When David said, against thee only have I sinned, in Psalm 51, and he had killed a man and committed adultery with his wife, or vice versa.
Right, right.
And then it wasn't only, but primarily, but that sense of the word. Maybe if we keep, you said stay faithful.
No, I think it's really helpful to think about those things. Those are practical things, and we all are challenged. And so just thinking and talking will help us. We will have to go back over and over again to Bible principles and work together on those things, but that's very practical, very helpful. All right, think about chapter 42. The famine comes. It's everywhere, including outside of Egypt. Including where Jacob lives with his sons. And he finds, he hears there's some grain in Egypt and they're starving. So he wants to send, as many as he can down to Egypt to get as much as possible. So he sends how many of his sons? 10. I thought he had 12 sons. Joseph's in Egypt, he can't send him. He's not about to send Benjamin. Why not? That's right. He is the new Joseph. He is the favored son on the block, and he's not about to send him. They're expendable, but nothing could ever happen to Benjamin. He was afraid harm might befall him. You guys, whatever. And so they go. Joseph, you know, you got to just imagine this scene. The last person they're expecting to find in charge of famine relief was their brother Joseph. He's now Egyptian, Egyptian clothing, Egyptian language, Egyptian customs, Egyptian whatever, haircut and all that. It's been 20 years, but he's probably looking for them. You know, if 10 brothers show up, let me know, you know. And so he recognizes them. They have no idea who he is. He puts them through a interrogation where they bumble it totally, but he's all knowing and they have no idea what's going on. He accuses them of being spies. I don't know. If you're going to send spies, would you send them in a group of a troop of 10? You know, I mean, it just doesn't make sense, but it doesn't have to make sense. He's got the power and he's got the grain. So you have to keep him happy. And, you know, he finally throws him in jail. And wow, you see their guilt. You know, he says, they say to each other in 21, truly we're guilty concerning our brother because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. Reuben said, and didn't I tell you do not sin against the boy and you would not listen? Now comes the reckoning for his blood. It's been 20 years. They get thrown in prison. What do they think of? It's what we did to Joseph. Reuben's like, I told you. You know, and Joseph's hearing it all. They don't know he could. You know, it was always cool in Brazil when I lived there. Few Brazilians can speak English. Now, when I lived there from 93 to 96, basically no Brazilian spoke English. You know, you could be talking on the bus about how ugly and fat the woman was sitting right beside you and nobody knew it. You know, it was really kind of cool. It was always disconcerting when I'd come back to the U.S. and be in a public place and start thinking, wait a minute. I can't just say everything I might want to because people around me could understand me. So they have no idea. They're talking Hebrew. These Egyptians don't understand. They can say anything and they're not. But Joseph does understand. It's emotional for him. And maybe the first time he learned about Reuben trying to spare him, save him. And so Joseph basically ends up saying, okay, I'm going to hold one of you as hostage. If original plan was hold all of them but one. I'll hold one of you as hostage. The rest of you go back. And you told me you have this little brother. You bring your little brother. Little, I mean, he's in his 20s. But you can bring your youngest brother back. And then I'll let him go. That'll prove you're honest men and not spies. That strikes me as the strangest, you know, plan in the world. Why don't they pick up any guy they want to and call him their little brother? I mean, how does he know? So, but again, he's got the power. He's got the grain. He doesn't have to make sense. You know, you don't question what the man says. And that's what they keep calling him throughout this, the man. And so they send him. You know which one he held hostage, right? Who did he hold? Simeon. Wonder why Simeon? Ever thought about that? Some of you have, I'm sure. He's the second. Oh, well, why not the first oldest? Reuben was on his side, didn't want him to be sold. He's found that out just now. You don't bind Reuben. He takes Simeon. That's what I think. Who knows? But so they go back. He puts their money back in their sacks with the grain. And one of them opens their sack on the way back home to give his donkey father. And he finds the money. Now, you know, think about it. You came down with money to buy grain. You know, you get grain in your sack. And you're halfway back home, you open it up, and there's your money. What would normal people think when they saw that money? How would you feel?
Lucky me.
Look, we got the money. I got this money. You know, who wouldn't think that, right? Them. He says, my money's been returned, and behold, it's even in my sack, and their hearts sank, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? You know, it'd be like, you know, thank God, I got this money. You never expected that. I mean, you know, you get some unexpected money in the mail, do you think, oh no, what have I done? What did God do to me? You know, it's like, well, wonderful. So what does this show about them? Guilt. They are hostages to their stricken consciences. They are so guilty. And, you know, it's just interesting. Every unexpected development to them is a sign that God's punishing them for what they did. They get back home, find the money in all their sacks. Wow, that's even worse. They're dismayed. End of 35. Their father Jacob said to them, verse 36, "You bereaved me of my children." Little did he know. "Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me." Of course, you don't ever know what's against you. The truth is, everything was for him, but he doesn't know. But he's just, oh, you know, Joseph's gone, Simeon's gone, now you want Benjamin, all is lost, woe is me. Reuben spoke to his father, saying, "You may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my care, and I will return him to you." Do you see a problem with what Reuben said? You can put your two grandkids to death if I don't bring him back. I'm sure he meant well, but that probably wasn't the most useful thing to say. And Jacob said, "My son," look at this in 38, "my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. My son won't go with you." You hear him say that? What does that mean for these other boys? They don't count his son. He's the only one left. Whoa! He doesn't care about Simeon languishing in jail. The only one that he cares about is nothing can ever happen to his special pet Benjamin. Benjamin's the favored baby of the family. You know, nothing can happen to Benjamin. Anything can happen to you guys that want to, but nothing's going to happen to Benjamin. Wonder what those boys think about Benjamin. So what they thought about Joseph, right? So, chapter 43, Jacob says, we're running low on food. Can you drop down there and get a little more food? I probably should pause. Do you have a question or comment to this point? You get in the middle of a story, it's hard to stop. Okay. Yes? There's a lot of things Jacob should never have done. Yeah. So, you know, he says, "Go on down and get some more." And Judah's like, "No, I mean, the man said, you won't see my face unless your brother's with you. We're not going unless Benjamin comes because the man said." You know, Jacob's like, you know, "Why'd you ever tell him you had a brother?" Well, how were they supposed to know he was going to say that? They just answered his questions. And Judah will remind his father, they'll all die if he doesn't go down and get the grain. I mean, is it better that Benjamin die of starvation or that they risk his life on the journey? I mean, I don't think dying of starvation is a great alternative. So pretty much Jacob doesn't have a choice, and he finally reluctantly agrees, and he sends all 11, well, 10, because Simeon's there, all 10 down, and they get there, and they bring the money that they had, and the more money, and they bring presents, and, you know, and they come, and the house steward says, "Oh, come on in," and they're scared, and they tell him, "Well, we got the money, and we're sorry, and we don't know what happened," and he said, "Well, I had your money, don't worry about it." And they are coming for this big meal at noon in Joseph's house, and they're terrified. But Joseph brings Simeon out. Here's the little brother. It's all good. Now he knows they're not spies. Everything's going, you know, just wonderfully. Some odd stuff happens at that meal. There are 11 of those guys. And except for Benjamin, it looks to me like they were all born in about a 7-year period. You know what? They're all seated in order of age. And these are not, you know, 2-year-olds now. These are guys that are what? In their 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever. 20s and 30s, perhaps. So, you know, how does he know that? And Benjamin gets 5 times more food at this banquet than the others do. That's a little odd also. There's just some kind of weird stuff going on here. And again, every time they think about this, anything that happens, you know, they interpret it as a sign of judgment. You know, it's an ominous development. They're just on edge about everything. So they get ready to go. Everything's good. They've got sold more grain, paid for it, you know, have grain in their sacks. 44 verse 1, Joseph commanded his house steward, saying, fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money for the grain. And he did as Joseph had told him. That's odd. I mean, the steward is not going to question his master. Okay, put the cup in there. But I mean, it's like, why does he want his cup to go into the sack of the youngest? He must have really liked that one. You know, give him his cup. You know, I don't know. And then, as soon as they leave, they've just barely left, when Joseph tells the house steward in verse 4, follow the men. And when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Is this the one from which my Lord drinks, and which he indeed uses for divination? You've done wrong in doing this. How did they think they could get by with this theft? Why, Joseph knows everything. He uses the cup for divination. He could track them anywhere. They've got the cup. You know, whatever. You know, again, nothing has to make sense with Joseph. He's got the money, the power, he got the whole thing. And you wonder, what is this house steward thinking? You know, he put the cup there, but Joseph's in power. You do what he says. And so he catches up to them, and he says to him in verse 7, why does my Lord speak such, he overtook and spoke these words, and they said back, why does my Lord speak such words as these? Far be it from your servants to do such a thing. Behold, the money which we found in the mouth of our sacks we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. How then could we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? With whomever of your servants it is found, let him die. Ouch. And we also will be my Lord's slave. They have no idea what they're saying. And he said, no. My master's a good man. Whoever it's with will be his slave, and the others will be innocent. So we'll just find out who took it. Well, in an Oscar-winning performance, this house steward goes to the sack of grain of the oldest one, and he unties it, and he opens it up, and he looks all through the sack, closes it up, and ties it up, and he goes to the second one. And he opens it up, goes through this procedure, sack by sack by sack by sack. What's happening with these brothers? Rising indignation. We told you we didn't steal that cup. How could you have accused us of stealing that cup? You know, and sack by sack, no cup, no cup, no cup, no cup, no cup, no cup, no cup. And the end of verse 12, ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. You're one of the brothers. The cup was in Benjamin's sack. How are you going to feel if you're one of those brothers? What are you going to think? I don't think so. That's not what I'd have thought. You know what I'd have thought? That stupid favored brother. What in the world? Isn't it enough that his dad pets him about everything, but he has to go and steal that cup and get us all in trouble over it? Isn't that what you'd feel? You know, wow. I mean, he's already this rat that his father wants to protect about everything. And let him out of the house once, and he swipes the special cup from Vice Pharaoh. You know, it's just got to be infuriating, you would think. Would be to me. Because they're in trouble because of what he did. They weren't going to put their hands on anything in that house. But little Benjamin has to go and steal the cup. They have a perfect opportunity to betray Rachel's other son, And they've got a perfect reason to do it now. He stole that cup. They didn't have much of a reason to do it for Joseph, just their jealousy of him. But do you understand what's going on here? In my judgment, Joseph set this whole thing up. Joseph, I think, was planning this from the time he accused him of being spies. He's done this whole thing because is he going to reveal himself to unrepentant brothers? He's trying to figure out, have they changed? So he puts them in a position where the easiest thing in the world would be to just say, okay, you know, we can't control him either. You know, take him. And their hands are clean. They can go back home and tell their father, look, we didn't tell him to steal that cup. We had no idea he did it. We were trying to watch him, you know. And you know, they're perfectly innocent in this matter. And they were. They didn't steal the cup for Benjamin. So he's got them where he wants them. And this is going to be a chance to see, will they get rid of the new Joseph when they have the opportunity? To me, this is the perfect masterminded setup to figure out, have they really changed? The circumstantial evidence is so overwhelming against them, they just go back home, fall on the ground. And Judah said, there's nothing we can say. We're all your slaves. And Joseph said, verse 17, far be it from me to do this. The man in whose possessions the cup has been found, he shall be my slave, but as for you, go up in peace to your father. Joseph's like, I'm a nice guy. I'm a fair guy. I don't blame you guys for this. I don't think it's not your responsibility what your brother does. He's the one with the cup. He's the one who stole it. We lock him up. You guys are free. Go ahead. See how he puts them in that position? Easiest thing in the world to say, you're right. We're sorry for about him. We can't do anything with him. And they're free. They go back to their father and say, you got a rotten son. One of the most emotional moments, I think, in Genesis, is this next speech. I believe it's the longest human speech in Genesis. This is Judah begging Joseph. Judah does this talking about your servant, our father, and all that. But your servant is me, your servant, our father, is Jacob. Listen to what he says. Verse 18. And think about what he's doing right here. Listen to what he's saying and what he's trying to get to happen. He said, oh, my Lord, verse 18, may your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears and do not be angry with your servant, for you are equal to Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servants, saying, have you a father or a brother? We said to my Lord, we have an old father and a little child of his old age. Now his brother's dead, so he alone is left with his mother, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me, that I may set my eyes on him. But we said to my Lord, the lad cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die. You said to your servants, however, unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. Thus it came about that when we went up to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. Our father said, go back, buy us a little food. But we said, we cannot go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down. But we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, surely he's torn in pieces, and I've not seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm befalls him, you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol, the grave, in sorrow. Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad's not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, when he sees that the lad is not with us, he will die. Thus your servants will bring down the gray hair of your servant, our father, down to Sheol in sorrow. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then let me bear the blame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad, a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, for fear that I see the evil that would overtake my father? Judah felt so much for his father that he begged to sacrifice himself for a brother loved more than he was. Have they repented? They're willing to do anything so that their father doesn't go through that again. Favoritism had been a reason to hate Joseph. It's now the reason to protect Benjamin. They are not going to see their father go through that again. Judah said, please let me be the slave. Let the lad go down. The lad that swiped that cup because he loved his father. And how could he see his father go through this grief again? That's just an amazing moment. I think, among other things, it shows you what guilt does. 20 years of feeling horrible about what you did to your father means you'll do anything not to put him through that again. I'll pause now. Thoughts and comments. Yeah.
Jeremy.
Good point. Yeah, good point. Thank you for pointing that out. I didn't, but that's exactly right. Judah's taking a lot of leadership by now in the family. Wes?
Is there any to Judah being a mediator that
means
foreshadowing
Anakin? At least Judah's leadership foreshadows Jesus, for sure. Maybe the mediator idea, I don't know. But yeah, certainly he's the kind of the go-to son right now. How do you feel, Joseph? You know, wow. Wow. How do you feel after that speech? Joseph couldn't control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, have everyone go out from me! So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I'm Joseph! Is my father still alive? Now, think about that. That is a bombshell. I mean, that is the last thing on their mind. But it has to be him. They haven't used his name. He wouldn't know that their brother was Joseph unless it was Joseph. Whew. I'm surprised they didn't die of a heart attack right there. And that's just a shock. That's terrifying. That's bewildering. That's just, they were paralyzed. His brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. I don't know if I'd have wanted to do that if I were them. And they came closer, and he said, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now he can take the revenge he's always wanted to. But he doesn't want to. He says, now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by great deliverance. Now therefore it was not you who sent me here, but God. He's made me a father of Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Joseph sees God's hand in this. Joseph totally forgives them, and he sends them back to fetch Jacob and the rest of the family and bring them down to Egypt. Just an impressive story. There's no way to tell this and do justice to it. Thoughts and comments? Conrad. Amen. Good point. Norm. So you're Joseph. At this point, if you could go back and redo your story, would you be okay with what you went through, given what you're able to do now in preserving the whole family and blessing your family and all that and being vice Pharaoh? I mean, there's so many times I can remember, this is a pathetic example compared to Joseph's, but one of, you know, and you realize how petty we are, but one of the lowest times for me was a moment for me was hard at the time. I was young. Two things were going on. There were more than this, but I had a really good study going with a family that we were really encouraged by. And I was moving. I decided I was discouraged. There were some things that happened that were really hard for me. And I tried out at a church that I was really excited about. I knew some people there, and I knew they'd tried out some other guys they were not satisfied with. So I was pretty sure, you know, they were going to ask me to come. It would have been a good opportunity. It was a college town. It would have been a good deal. There were several things about it that I really liked. I thought I could do some good. And so I was really excited about that. So 3 weeks later, one of the elders calls me and said, we're not going to have any of the men we've talked to so far come. We're going to look around some more. That was really disappointing. And that same day, this family we were studying with, it was going so great, calls and says, we don't want to study anymore and we don't want to talk about it. And to this day, I have no idea what happened. Those two things together, when I was young, just really discouraged me. It was really disappointing, really disheartening. It was kind of one of those things where, all right, I don't understand God. Here I want to do your will. I want to do something for you. I think this is going to be a good thing. And you're stymieing me from doing something that I think would be helpful. I didn't turn on God, but it was really hard for me. Now, the next step was, a few weeks later, I ended up agreeing to, and a few months after that, going to a church that I wasn't as excited about. But it was a good situation. Turned out it was the best 5 years of my life. Two excellent elders that shepherded me and changed my life a lot. And the church I wanted to go to split in an ugly split about a year later that I certainly would not have been prepared at my age to have helped in. I recognized, wow, what I thought was so bad was really great. I just didn't know it at the time. Now, I know that's pathetic compared to what Joseph went through. But even in the setbacks we have, if we will just serve the Lord, He is in control. He does know what He's doing. Sometimes, a lot of times, we can look back and we can say, oh, I see why now. This makes perfect sense. Thank you. Sometimes we may not be able to do that. You know, we may never understand, or it may be 13 years before we do, or whatever. But I think the trust in God is helpful. Think about this. I think I may have done this here at one point, and I do this some different ways. But let's just do it this way. I'm going to ask the question, who am I? See if you can figure out who I am. Who am I? I am the beloved son of my father. My father sent me far away on an errand of kindness. In carrying out my mission, my own people, because of jealousy, delivered me into the hand of strangers. I was sold for some shekels of silver. I was strongly tempted, but resisted. When an old man saw my face, he said he could die now. Because of my righteousness, I was falsely accused and condemned. I was stripped of my robe. Two others were punished with me, though one of them was restored. But God was with me and reversed the hideous injustices. I came to have all authority, second only to the supreme monarch himself. Even those who sold me ultimately bowed down before me. I became the means whereby God saved the very ones who wronged me. After my quote-unquote death, I was revealed first to the 10, then to the 11. Who am I? Isn't that amazing? There's so much depth in the Bible. How could God design a story this awesome, and then on another level, it is an incredible foreshadowing of Jesus? There's more to it than that, but those are some of the key points of parallel. It's just amazing. And no human writer can write at that many levels. And Jesus comes along, you know, thousands of years later. It's just incredible. The design and the perfection of the scripture. So I think that's cool. Thoughts and comments on chapter 45. Well, I'm not going to say as much about the rest of the book, but I'd like to say a few things about what happens. So chapter 46, the family moves down to Egypt, about 70 of them, depends on which passage you're thinking about and which ones he's counting and which ones he's not. And they move down there, and they settle in this special territory. the Egyptians don't like herdsmen, and so they don't really want to be around them, so they put them kind of in their own isolated good pasture ground, really a win-win here in the land of Goshen. And the brothers go in and see Pharaoh. Actually, Jacob goes and sees Pharaoh. It's kind of funny in chapter 47, verse 8. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How many years have you lived?" So Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life." 130, few and unpleasant. But you think about it, they haven't been too easy. Ran away, and I have an unhappy marriage. His daughter was forced. His favorite wife died. He was detached for years from his favorite son. It hadn't been easy. Now, some of it he's brought on himself, but it hadn't been easy. And you might think about this. This is just curiosity. I don't know what to do with this particularly. But if you think about the relationship between Joseph and Jacob, the first 17 years of Joseph's life, they were together. And the last 17 years of Jacob's life, they were together. Jacob goes down at 130, dies at 147. So, for whatever that's worth, tells us a little bit about Joseph is really faithful to Pharaoh. And so he sells the grain for money until their money runs out, for livestock till the livestock runs out, for the land until the land runs out, and then for their own lives. And basically they become Pharaoh's slaves, so they give a percentage, a small percentage of everything to the crown, and he gives them the seed, and they're going to just work as basically indentured servants to Pharaoh. So he's really blessed Pharaoh in this. That's who he's working for. Then Jacob dies. Well, before he does, he asks his bones to be taken down to Egypt and buried, and he blesses his children. So, all right, you know the firstborn deal. The firstborn gets the double portion of the inheritance. So if you're going to do that mathematically, divide the inheritance in one more parts than you have sons, and give the oldest one two of the parts and all the others one part. So they've got 12 sons divided into 13 parts. Give the oldest one two and all the others one. But he's not going to give the double portion to Leah's oldest. He gives the double portion to Rachel's oldest, who is actually number 11. Who is Rachel's oldest? Joseph has two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. So what he does is he makes Manasseh and Ephraim, he elevates them to son status. He gives each of them one part. That way Joseph has two parts, all the others have one part, and so you've got the division with the firstborn. So actually, if you think about it that way, how many tribes were there? 13. We don't ever say there were the 13 tribes of Israel, right? What do we say? The 12. Why do we say 12 if there were 13? The Levites we don't count. Why don't we count them? Yeah, they didn't get a territorial inheritance. They got 48 cities, pretty close to four from every tribe, spread out over the whole land. So when we think about the tribes that got territory, that's not Levites. So we talk about the 12 tribes, but really there were 13 tribes, if you count the Levites also. And then when Jacob's going to give the blessing to Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph sort of stage manages this to where Manasseh, the oldest, is underneath his right hand and Ephraim underneath his left hand. Except Jacob, when he goes to give the blessing, crosses his hands over and puts his right hand on Ephraim and his left hand on Manasseh. And Joseph tries to get him back in the right place. And Jacob says, no, they're both going to be blessed, but Ephraim will be superior. He will have the dominance over Manasseh, the younger over the older. How many times does that happen in the book of Genesis? And so that's the way it is. I mean, if you think about it, which was the more outstanding tribe, Ephraim or Manasseh? Manasseh was important, one of the more important tribes, but Ephraim even more important than they were. So that comes true as he said it would. That's what I'm going to say through chapter 48. Most of those things are pretty easy to get if you'll just read them. Thoughts and comments you want to make up to that point?
Yeah,
Yes.
Is this where he talked about the younger being the firstborn, where it showed preeminence rather than firstborn born, like Jesus, preeminent, firstborn of all creation? He's over it, not part of it. And this firstborn meaning preeminent, not just born first.
Well, certainly that is a correct statement. I'm not sure if there's a statement here that says that. There are some statements in the Bible that I think do lend themselves to that, and you always see that the firstborn is the preeminent one. You know, in Psalm 89:27, I also shall make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. There are some statements that I think lend themselves to that. I'm not sure there is one here. There may be that I'm just not thinking of, so I don't know. Psalm 89:27. Other questions or comments? Okay, look at chapter 49. This is kind of an interesting chapter. We're going to go about 5 or 10 more minutes and then stop here, so we're not going to give a break, but we're going to be able to conclude in a few minutes. If you need to leave for any reason, you're welcome to, but we won't go much longer. So in chapter 49, he blesses the 12 sons. This is interesting because he clearly has God's guidance in doing this. Reuben, the firstborn, well, verse 4, he was uncontrolled as water. He would not have the preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. So Reuben's lack of controlling his impulses, his unreliability, meant he wasn't going to have a leadership role, and he didn't. Reuben got that territory down there in the bottom of Gilead on the right-hand side. Never amounted to much. Simeon and Levi, verse 5 to 7, they were the ones that in their self-will slew men. And he says in verse 7, cursed be their anger, for it's fierce, and their wrath, for it's cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Egypt. So they were scattered. Levi, cities all over, 48 cities, 3 to Naphtali, 9 to Judah and Simeon together, and 4 to all the other tribes. So basically 4 per tribe. So they're scattered. That was a blessing, though, to Levi. It meant they were there to teach people in all the different places. Simeon, on the other hand, they just get some cities inside Judah's territory. And Simeon's kind of, they become kind of a non-entity eventually. I don't know that there's just a whole lot of focus on Simeon. We see him a couple times, but they seem to maybe even have migrated north. I don't know. There's a couple passages a little difficult to know how to interpret. And then he emphasizes Judah. In verse 8, Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down to you. And he says in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. The kingship would come from Judah, and they'd be prosperous. They'd wash their garments in wine. Wine's pretty, you're pretty wealthy if you can use wine to wash your clothes in. And so they're going to be blessed. They're going to be prosperous. They're going to be dominant. The Messiah is going to come from them. Zebulun in 13 is going to be associated with the sea. 14 and 15, Issachar is going to prefer peace to liberty. Dan is going to be cunning and fierce in 16 to 18. Gad, it's hard to interpret what he's saying there in that one verse. Asher would eat well in 20. Naphtali would enjoy the outdoors. Joseph, he again mentions, though he's blessed his two sons in 22 to 26. In 27, Benjamin is going to be a ravenous wolf. His leaders were great warriors. So you just see son by son kind of a foreshadowing of what they were going to be like, what the tribes were going to be like. This is his last blessing before he dies and his remains are taken to the land of Canaan, because he knows the people by God's promise will eventually go back there and be dominant there. Thoughts and comments on chapter 49. And then chapter 50. Joseph and his brothers bury Jacob. And after they do, the brothers are all worried that now Joseph's going to punish them. They didn't really believe he had totally forgiven them. They say, you know, our father said, you know, forgive us. I don't know if he really did or if they made that up, but either way, they're really troubled. They're really worried about what may happen to them. And unjustifiably so, Joseph, he's totally forgiven them. He says in verse 19, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So Joseph is clearly not at all holding a grudge against them or anything like that. Then Joseph finally dies. He orders before he dies his bones be preserved. And when they go up in the Exodus, centuries later, that his bones be taken and buried in the land of Canaan as well. I think those statements on Jacob and Joseph's part show a lot of faith. They trust that God's promises will be fulfilled, and then he dies. So what we've had in Genesis, as we suggested, four great sins. Adam and Eve's, Cain's, the flood, sins provoking that, and the Tower of Babel, and four great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. To me, that's a good way of just kind of summarizing the content of the book of Genesis. Okay, comments and questions about all that. All right. Well, it's been great to be here. I really do appreciate your eagerness and interest and excitement in doing studies like this. I think this is a great thing to do. You know, we need to want to study, and it's fun. And I think the more we do it, the more we enjoy it. So I appreciate the opportunity. Great to be around you guys. Really encouraging. Service this morning was so encouraging. So I really appreciate all that, and I'm sure somebody will finalize here. So.